Okay, so we're half of the health and culture outfit, and we quickly decided we were asked to consider whether cultural diversity influences health and well-being. These were not our questions. We just, you know, docilely received them. And we were also asked to consider whether there were, in our view, any historical and cultural domains that impact on human health and medicine. And we quickly dismissed both of these questions as being self-evidently true. So we quickly came to the conclusion that, of course, cultural diversity influenced health and well-being, and of course there were historical and cultural domains that influenced human health and medicine. And then what we really ended up spending our time doing was discussing to what extent it was necessary to have larger models of how society works and how individual choice is made if one was going to successfully implement public health policies. And we spent some time talking about the extent to which one needed to consider whether society was built up of individuals who could then individually make choices about their health behavior, or whether one really needed to have a model that acknowledge the extent to which larger social forces and issues of politics and capitalism and money and even, well, you know, et cetera, shape the ability of individuals to act autonomously. And we thought that fundamentally this was the most interesting area of overlap, but that fundamentally then that converts, that makes this into a question about implementing health policy.
We're the other half of the health and culture group as well. We've started off again looking at the first question about how cultural diversity influences health and well-being. And I think we discussed a number of different issues about religion and how that could affect health and people's perception of health and whether it would be acceptable to be treated because of your religion and at what level. And then I think we moved on to discussing what dictates the level of healthcare in a population, what is acceptable. So we know that there's limited resources. And we know that, obviously, for example, in the West, there might be only a very expensive cancer drug that's available for treatment for cancer. But should that be given? So we were starting to go down that line as to say what are the questions we should be asking as to whether what level of healthcare each individual is allowed to have, and is there a limit, and how could we look at how resources could be spread, I think, more equitably. I think that was the main points that we were discussing. Any other points? the other main topic we were looking at was the cultural perception of health and what is acceptable, again, to different cultures, and how I think we were saying, you know, some things might seem to be, I can't remember what the main point was. The causes of ill health in different cultures. So we were talking about the fact that in some cultures there's religious and perhaps other connotations as to why you might become unhealthy, and therefore the treatment of that disease is quite complicated because you've got to deal with the religious beliefs behind why someone's ill rather than just treating the medical consequences of the medical things leading up to that disease.
Okay. Right. So, cultures of translation. I think we may have been very simplistic, and maybe there's great depths in this that we've totally missed, but anyway, we were asked how a language, texts, and national identity connected. Well, we felt that national identity, there is an essential link to language, and we looked at various examples of this. Language, which could perhaps be used as a weapon, as a division. For example, in Sri Lanka, who had wars, civil war for many, many years, now there is peace, and the two languages, Tamil and Sinhala, are both the official languages, but it still hasn't got over the fact that there are great divisions there. If we look at the South Tyrol, which the Austrians lost, when they lost most of their territories, they lost to Italy. So South Tyrol belongs to Italy, but it is essentially German-speaking. And although it has this Italian nationality, you go there and everything there shrieks German, Austrian at you, the culture, the architecture, and of course the language, because the majority of people who are living there are still German-speaking. And in fact, during the fascist time, the speaking and the teaching of Italian was forbidden, of German, sorry, was forbidden. But that didn't last, and of course, once fascism was passed, then the teaching of German came back. So that I see, well, we see as how silencing a language actually doesn't work, and that is again a weapon that can not succeed in the long term. And then we wondered how Swiss see themselves. They speak French, German, Italian, and Romansh in that country. So what is their nationality? Yes, they are Swiss, but do they see themselves as Valaisan or Eastern Swiss, German-speaking Swiss, or from Ticino? And having spent some time living there, I know that each of those three language groups, well, four, but the main three, regard each other with a degree of suspicion. If we look at what does translation mean for you and how does it impact on your professional and personal life, we felt that on our personal lives, being able to speak languages and read languages enables us to enjoy literature, the arts, books, opera, in the source language. And that gives you a sensitivity that you do not get even from a good translation. What is very important is to have that ability to go to a country and to get under the skin of the local people by being able to converse with them in their language, and they will open up far more than if you speak to someone who, even if they speak English. We're seeing this, the ability to self-translate with people who are sending out messages from war-torn places like Syria on Facebook and whatever in English so that they can get to the widest possible area. In our professional lives, my neighbor here enjoys teaching and exploring literature. We have had the benefits of speaking languages. Both Susan and I have used languages in our work. It opens up contacts with your peers when you're traveling overseas, and you get far more out of business meetings if you can speak their language. And I have to say, I got a better paid job because I spoke languages. So there we go. That's very down to earth.
Yes, we very much agree with that group, although we didn't exchange ideas with them. But the main point that emerged from our discussion was that translation is not innocent. It's always done for a purpose and is a political act. Either when and how and for whom it is languages are translated, and or also we discuss the political act of not translating, of not letting minority languages speak, and encouraging monolingual societies. This can be a political act as well. And it also emerged that being able to speak source and target language enables the reader to understand that sometimes translation is too transparent for the reader and doesn't really convey what the source culture wants to say. This has been experienced from Spanish into English, yeah? And we were discussing other things, and we all agree that translation needs to be bicultural rather than simply bilingual. That's all.
So we had a very interesting discussion with a lot of cultural issues as well with memory. I think one of the questions we had was how does one infer collective memory from individual? And I believe that's one of the things you discussed at the other table as well, because there's this whole idea that we have one memory of a culture. And if it's something which is done through through Napoleon or the political level, that's easy enough. But because we are moving to this level of individual histories, individual memories, I think it's difficult to do in inferring of general principles. And we also really thought the whole idea of destruction of memory, which is something that Anton talked about, was very interesting with Russia. And we had someone on our table from Hungary, and the same idea occurred where, due to political reasons, there's a change in collective memory as well, a more willful change in memory. So it was all a very interesting discussion.
To continue the collective memories, we represented mostly the Eastern Bloc, basically, presenting post-Soviet countries and Russia as well. And we were wondering about different directions of collective memories and how they are built from the individual memories. And we all kind of were surprised by the fact that, for example, we all speak Russian language, even though we are from different countries. So how did it happen and why do we remember it? So we agreed that the Soviet educational system was very effective on erasing like national identities and creating totally new thing as a Soviet community, Soviet culture. So we do speak the same language. We don't need to translate each other. And at the same time, we were talking about manipulating within the collective memories, because collectively the memory can be manipulated and formed in a way that politics need it or somebody else. But individually, we remember certain things that are not known to anybody else except us. And we are kind of holding them inside and sometimes even dying away without telling it to anybody else. So this was also a question of how valuable is our memory about our families, our roots. If we don't know them, do we live better or worse, or how does it affect our life, whether our genealogical tree is full of families and we know where we come from. Also, we spoke about cultural diversity within the memory, and we came up with examples about Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, where she says about Yeltsin, for example, how nowadays some people say that he is a kind of icon of democracy. At the same time, we forget how he like ordered to shoot people in 1990s. And for instance, also we remembered some personalities, how we perceive individuals, like massively known individuals as Hitler. We will never think he was a good person because it's a like collective memory about him. But for instance, Michael Jackson, now he's known as an idol, and nobody says anything bad about him anymore, even though 2 years before he died, he was completely poured with black colors, let's say. And also we talked about Finland as a not part of Eastern Bloc, but also kind of having their own small memories, as for instance, Russian-Finnish war, which they remember particularly well, and they all of them, from small children to the old people, they do remember it. But for example, for Russians, it's totally nothing. They don't remember this kind of war. And this is a different memory about the same subject, same event from different perspectives. So yeah, there are differences.
Well, we talked about the I Was Here exhibition, the George Shaw exhibition. And one of the things we picked up was the titles he gave, the pictures. Each one of the pictures he did in his Airfix model paint started off with the title, The Passion. And then there was a description of a road or a place with a church or some garages or what have you. And it struck me because George Shaw went through the whole Catholic full immersion experience like we did, that he used his Catholic upbringing either consciously or subconsciously when he was actually titling the paintings, because they were kind of infused with a sense of loneliness and melancholia. And even in the blurb, when it was talking about the pictures, used a quote from Larkin about the clarification of loneliness. And of course, anyone who's gone through the whole Catholic experience will associate the word passion in not just red hot bloodedness, but with the suffering, Jesus kind of going on the cross and all that side of things. So we were looking at how you can actually interpret particular things, particularly visual sort of art or what have you. You will interpret things on the basis of your own particular experiences, your own particular cultural experiences, and your memories and their memories will somehow fuse into something that's meaningful to you both that may not be meaningful to other people looking on.